I'm John Marty. I'm a state senator, not a U.S. senator, from Minnesota. Actually representing, for those who are from Minnesota, part of St. Paul and several suburbs just north of there. And today's topic, short title, is Where Have All the Political Leaders Gone? And it's basically a look at why one's interest in re-election, among other factors, causes everyone in our, almost everyone in our political system, state, local, national, to avoid tough decisions, ducking the tough issues in order perhaps to get reelected. And I guess I'd like to open up by asking people, not for a one or two word answer to this, but if people have how you would define political leadership, two, three sentence type of definition of that. I'd like to throw out some. Here are some answers, what people would describe it as.
I look at it as very self-seeking, especially with political leaders in my area.
Not looking for what politicians are, whether they're leaders or not, but what the word leadership means. What would you call, how would you define a political leader? Not, you don't have to name one, you don't have to. If you have an example, either an example of what political leadership is or what you think, what the term means to you, and not what
it involves. A certain amount of courage.
Can you expand a little bit?
I'm sorry?
Can you expand a little bit on that?
Well, not being so thin-skinned, that willing to address tough issues and willing to be wrong, but willing to take a stand. I just finished a book on Winston Churchill, and he went against the odds for 6 years against everybody.
Many times, yes. Go ahead.
Well, when I think about a political leader, I'm not thinking about anybody, I'm thinking about the epitome of what they should be, would be a person who says to himself, how do my constituents feel about this? What is the feedback I'm getting as I go out into the community? And to keep associating with that community instead of putting himself in a cocoon in his office or associating with just the same likes in my case, in Jefferson City, but keep contact with the people out there, a political leader.
Okay, so keeping contact with what the people want in effect,
right.
Too. So. Okay.
Well, I'd like to see some kind of vision, something beyond the daily drudgery. I must say I see that in almost every area. A leader, I think, has to have a vision which goes beyond the daily task. There are many people who can do the daily task, but I think a leader, per se, should have the ability to perhaps identify issues earlier. He should have a feel for what's coming. There should be some vision out there in terms of where he's going at this particular time, this particular instant in history. And at the same time, he should be rather practical in order to deal with the issues that are there. I think both of those things are things that I would look for.
Vision and practicality.
Yeah, it's sort of that horizontal and vertical relationships that you have. There has to be a balance.
You can almost take that with an issue, though. Like the spotted owl issue. You got the coast of Washington there, and you have all these people that are going to be out of work, yet none of the political leaders had a vision to see that, man, we better get some kind of other industry in there so those people have an income so we don't destroy that community.
You're waiting until too long, not lacking the vision to see this is going to come to a crisis if we don't do something. Doug?
I'd say, ideally, a political leader should be one who would be willing to engage in the tensions, the dialectic, controversial tensions, and idealistically be able to do so bipartisan, to for a moment to set that aside, even their own biases, as possible as that can be, to enter into the tension, to wrestle with the issues as complex as they are, and then from that, maybe even at times going against their constituents for the sake of what might be best in that vision.
Okay. I like these comments. If anybody has any one they really want to add, go ahead.
I'm going to take exception to the serving. Or you got to stay in tune with constituency, but I think a leader goes beyond their constituency. Mm-hmm. I think the routine politician stays in touch with his constituency, while the real leader goes beyond that to a national issue that he's important to the country, that is, may in fact go against his constituency, like you were saying.
Yeah, I think you two are showing one of the tensions with her comments and so on, one of the tensions in this issue. So,
yeah, but what we're seeing now is oftentimes that vision, but I mean, you have to be practical too.
Well, this is the conflict for the politician.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, appreciate that, and I think that's a lot of those comments are things I guess I see in terms of what's missing in our political process right now. About a year or 2 years ago, Time magazine had a cover issue about why government doesn't work and the can't do Congress or something like that, and it was criticizing the federal government specifically for failure to act on any major issue until it's, well, too late. SNL crisis was a big high point at that time, and they were talking about this, and one of the things that strikes me about one of the causes, I think, of what I'd call is a lack of leadership, a lack of willingness to address those problems, is self-serving interest in re-election. Somebody, after yesterday's talk, came up to me and asked about various proposals for more turnover in Congress or something, and it has been joked 4 or 5 years ago, before the Soviet Union's government structure had changed a lot. The Supreme Soviet used to be very steady, and I mean, they were lifetime type of appointments, and somebody said there's less turnover in the U.S. Congress than the Supreme Soviet, and there was some truth to that. Congressional legislators are virtually always reelected. Not always, but virtually always, and the president right now is with an approval rating of 70%+, I mean, record high approval ratings. Incumbents are learning how to take care of themselves. Political job security is probably higher than it's ever been. And yet, despite the fact that people are very secure in their jobs, they're very unwilling to make tough decisions. And I'd say there's no leadership to be found out there, or not much. Perhaps it's something that was learned in the early 80s. You don't have to be consistent with your message, and you don't need to say no. You don't have to be unpopular. You can just say what the people want to hear, and even if it's inconsistent, they like you for it. I don't know that they like you because of that, but they like what they hear early on and so on. So early 80s, we had new administration and Congress going along with basically the whole thing of cutting taxes and increasing spending, particularly in military areas in the early 80s. But there was increased spending and massive cuts in taxes. And deficits climbed extremely high levels. The current deficit, if it's at about $200 billion deficit, which depending on the year goes up and down, $100 billion from that, that means that the federal government's spending roughly $800 to $1,000 more per person than it's taking in. And your family budget can look a lot better if for every member in your household you spend $1,000 more per year than your income is. Things go a lot easier that way. And everybody agrees a deficit isn't a good thing to have, but it's not a crisis issue. It's kind of a long-term problem. And you can please everybody if you work to hold down taxes and spend more on other things. And people learn real quickly. And President Reagan was doing some of this. Every time somebody complained about the deficit, what he'd do is call for a constitutional amendment to avoid deficit spending. Nothing to significantly change the way things are working. You call for something that's kind of irrelevant to the process. Graham Rudman budget reconciliation process was set into effect about that time, and it basically required Congress to come up with balanced budgets. So we should have them by now, but, well, you can make exceptions to it. And in a case of an emergency, which you realistically have to have, so everything becomes an emergency then. And so you start using budget tricks to get around it, and people learn very quickly that they could avoid making tough decisions, and their re-election rates may soar as a result of that. Well, campaign literature is the title of this seminar was supposed to be. Leadership is everywhere in campaign literature, television advertisements, brochures. It tells you so-and-so, a true leader for the 90s, or leadership for our community. It's a, everybody claims it in their literature, and when mostly what's offered is good dose of followership, perhaps. So what makes leadership so difficult to find? Why is it so elusive? I guess it's, I think it's the fear of being left alone, unpopular, and certainly unemployed as a politician, that do that. And there's clearly a risk in leadership. Reading about Winston Churchill, reading about others, in a democracy, if you are unpopular, you don't survive. And there is a risk when you make decisions that may offend people. So there's certainly some risk involved in doing so. And self-preservation is a very natural and understandable motivator for us. I want to keep my job very much. I love what I'm doing, and I work very hard to get elected, and I'm going to do it again next year. And I want to get reelected. I wouldn't spend the time and effort to do it if I didn't care about it. So it is a self-motivator to do that. It does go even beyond what makes rational sense, however. I have one colleague who told me after voting with some interest group that he felt compelled to vote with, but was very upset at, he said, boy, someday I'm going to decide not to run again, then I'm going to vote against him every time that last year or so. Well, I've seen people who are on their way out who don't agree with an interest group but are scared to death of the interest group and will still vote with them in their last day in the legislature. Why? Because it's such a habit. You know, it's they want to be liked. They want to be popular. They want to be reelected. Even when they decide they don't want to be reelected anymore, it's hard to get out of that habit. Well, what does leadership require? You mentioned, I think, two of the things you need. Certainly a vision, an understanding of what the problems are and some sort of ability to devise a solution for that. This morning in McGinnis's talk, somebody said, well, it was talk about vision, and somebody said, how do you develop a dream? How do you find out what your dream is or your vision is? Well, I'm not sure the exact answer to that question, but I do know there are a lot of people in the world who, in our society, who have a vision for the way things ought to be. They find various aspects of our society very unsettling, very offensive, and they want to change them, or they think we ought to change them, and they may even have solutions for it. There are lots of people with vision, people with a great vision who have the solution to a problem and are willing to fight hard for it. They may be more rare, and the people who can creatively work towards those solutions may be fairly rare as well, but certainly leadership does require somebody to have a vision of what's wrong and what you can do to change it. Just saying, well, taxes are too high, or this is too bad, or our schools stink, or there's too much gambling, or whatever, that's not a vision. That's just looking around and saying, ah, that's terrible. The vision comes in seeing what you can do about it and seeing how you can change it. And I'd suggest that beyond the vision, somebody needs to have a deep, committed belief about the seriousness of the problem and their willingness to and the need to act, and the need to act now, and the need to fight hard for it, even, as I said, at some risk. And finally, a willingness to stand up to those who oppose it. And the tension on the issue you mentioned about listening to constituents, I think, is a very real one in an elected democracy. And it's a debate that's been going on since the beginning of democracies over what the role of an elected representative is to do. Is it to take a poll of their constituents and do exactly what their constituents want, or is it to do what they think is the right thing to do? I'd argue that basically it leans more towards doing what they think is the right thing to do, but in doing so, in listening to their constituents. And common sense, political sense, is going to make them do some listening anyway. And I think it's important to not be out of touch with what constituents want. It is, however, as you mentioned, not appropriate, it's not leadership to just do what your constituents want. One U.S. congressman a number of years ago wrote a column talking about how when he was first elected, one of his constituents wrote him a long, detailed letter telling him the 13 points that would solve all of our government's problems. And he said the first 12 of them, there were things that were suggesting, well, we ought to spend more to make our schools better places. And the first 12 were basically things that we ought to do more, spend more in this area. And the 13th one was cut taxes. And he said, you know, Congress carried out this guy's plan to the T. And and the public and myself and everyone in this room has that same kind of desire. We want everything. We don't want to pay for anything. I mean, there are exceptions to that. I mean, people can say, well, I don't want this. I don't want our government to be doing this, or I don't want to be doing that, or sure, I'm willing to pay for this. There are certainly exceptions, but the gut level instinct is nobody likes to pay taxes, and everybody wants things, and the public opinion switches. So one of the things is the public opinion is not always consistent with itself. Another thing is public opinion does shift, and if we have people, as some people have proposed, now that we're getting new technologies and almost every home in the country has a television set and more are getting cable sets where you can, at some point technology-wise, we could probably interact and have 15 minutes a day in which you vote on all the issues, get rid of Congress, and just have people punch buttons, yes, I favor this, no, I favor this. I don't know that that would be a great system for running a country. I think a town meeting in a small town in New Hampshire might be an appropriate way to run a small town. I don't think it's the way you try and run a major country or state or a larger community, and I'd suggest that that's where leadership can and is needed, not merely public opinion. However, certainly one of the things that leads to your frustration about politicians not listening to the public is because of the sense that politicians are listening to somebody other than their own belief. They're listening to special interest groups, and I don't say that in necessarily a derogatory manner, but they are listening to certain interest groups, not the public at large. And the feeling that sometimes they're looking more out for the special interest than the public interest is a legitimate reason people have to keep in touch with what the public interest is. But there is this tension on who you're supposed to, how you're supposed to represent people. And I'd argue that the true role of an elected representative in a democracy like ours is for the politician to use their best judgment. Everybody in this room doesn't have 8-10 hours a day to study the current political issues and do the background work needed to make the decisions on them. How many of you spend more than half an hour a day reading the news in the paper? When you take out the sports section and variety section and other things like that, not many people spend more than a half hour a day, and that's state, local, and national news and a whole lot of stuff about murders and kidnappings and interesting events and weather and so on thrown in there. And one of the things I'd argue an elected representative is there to do is to study the issues and use their best judgment. And then I'd argue furthermore that it's their responsibility not to duck on that, but to go out and explain why they did that. And in an ideal situation, the way a democracy works, if they don't do a good job of explaining why they took the positions they took, their constituents think this individual is not the right one for us and we'll vote that person out of office. And democracy done that way, I think, would work pretty well. We have shied quite a bit away from that. And I'd argue a lot of that does come from this unwillingness to stand up to those who oppose these things. And leadership is not going to be popular with everybody. If I tell you what I think a leadership position on issue A is, half of the room is likely to disagree and disagree strongly with me on that. Controversial issues tend to develop strong opinions on both sides of the issues, and you're not going to have unanimity on controversial issues. So you have to recognize that not everybody's going to agree with the direction of leadership, and who puts the pressure on, why do politicians bow to these, to doing something other than what they think in their own best judgment is the right way to go. I'd suggest there's several types of groups that sway people. One of them is certainly public opinion. There are certain things I could give you a pretty good guess where my constituency would stand on those issues. There's certainly single issue groups. There are special interest lobbies, people who are interested in something affecting their own particular business or industry or neighborhood or whatever. And finally, I'll suggest a fourth group is one's own political colleagues, the political inner circle. In the legislature, it's your colleagues. In an administrative, governor may, among fellow governors, there's a certain amount of wanting to be popular and not be an outcast. So of these four groups, let me give examples of what it may mean standing up to them. Let me take on public opinion, death penalty. I'll take where I stand on it and where I think public opinion is. I think if I polled my constituency, I would suggest a majority of them definitely support the death penalty. Maybe not in every crime, not in every major crime, but in certainly a lot of them. And the federal government, the U.S. Congress, is right now working on a bill that's going to expand the number of death penalty cases overwhelmingly. And there are certainly issues that even the U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice is lobbying for a bill to make it fewer appeals available to some prisoner on death row, because the public doesn't like all these routine appeals over and over. This guy did it. We know he's guilty. Let's go up and shoot him or whatever and get rid of him. I've always opposed the death penalty for a number of reasons. It's applied in a discriminatory fashion. I mean, we've had cases several years ago, a person who was sentenced to death whose lawyer showed up the first day in court drunk, totally unaware of, spent no time with the prisoner. The judge convicted threw the lawyer in jail for contempt of court. The next day they were both, the lawyer and the prisoner, were hauled out of jail and into the courtroom, and the trial proceeded. The person was convicted of it. Innocent people this century have been executed, innocent in the sense that we know several years later, after an execution, somebody later came in with new evidence or somebody else confessed to the crime. As the system works now, death penalty is more expensive than life imprisonment. That could certainly change if we throw out all chance for appeal, but that certainly makes it more and more likely you're going to have mistakes where innocent people are executed. But you could make it cheaper by just saying, well, one quick appeal and that's it. And prison costs are very high. In Minnesota, they're close to $30,000 per year. And if a 20-year-old commits a crime and you keep them locked up for 60 years, it's a lot of money. But executing a person by the time you go through the legal appeals, it is very expensive, more expensive than that would be. And it certainly, as I said, the discriminatory fashion. 30 years ago, most southern states, if you were black convicted of raping a white, it was a death, capital crime. If it was a white convicted of raping a black, it was not a capital crime. The laws were just different. There's a recent study that came out that suggested that while the laws are changed and are now racially neutral, the same impact happens. And this guy had analyzed cases for the last 15 years or so, and there simply were no people who were executed, whites who had killed blacks, the other way around. And he took the number of cases, he balanced the number of cases out, so he was taking an equal number of one race on the other versus the other way around, and he found out the same thing happens as the law 30 years ago. Only now the law is not there, now it's just because of bias and perhaps economics, because of people's ability to get decent lawyers. Most death row cases, the lawyers are often, in many southern states at least, they tend to be third-year law students. Pro bono lawyers aren't available for a lot of these things. Certain northern states often send lawyers down to handle death penalty cases because these states won't provide good lawyers, good legal representation, which we consider important. And finally, there's no evidence that the death penalty is a deterrent. And I frankly think it's wrong for us to kill people who kill people to show other people that killing people is wrong. So I go into this long background to explain why I think the death penalty is wrong, and yet my constituency would, if we took a poll of them, I'll guess 55% to 60% of them would disagree with me. I think that if we come up with a vote on this, and I vote against it, I'm going to spend a lot of time explaining it to constituents, and I think I can persuade a decent number of them. If not, that I have the right position on the issue, that, well, at least I've thought it through and I'm not such a jerk for being pro-murderers and pro-rapists and pro-everybody else, that they can say, well, they disagree with me on that issue, but they will continue to support me. So I'm not afraid to tell my constituents where I stand on that issue, but I will argue that it is an awesome task to go out and tell your constituents you disagree with them, and you know you do. Of course, often when you take majority opinion, it's your impression of it. I have not polled my constituents on it. Very few people do extensive polls. I do a questionnaire every year to find out where my constituents are coming from on a number of issues, but that's not scientifically done. The thing I find valuable about that is the additional comments and suggestions people write on it. And that's where I spend my time. Sure, I tally up the rest of it, but I basically spend time hearing what people's comments are. And so most often, not only is there a problem with determining what public opinion is on any given day, but the issues change so much. I can ask people how they feel about a certain issue, and when it comes time to a vote in the legislature, the controversial issue is going to be on something that's not directly asked in that poll you took. So there's no good way to know exactly what popular opinion is, and that's certainly, the voters are the ones who give us our jobs, and we're accountable to them, and so taking them on and knowing you're disagreeing with more than half of them is a frightening thing to do. The second type of thing I'll suggest is the single issue groups, and this is often contrary to public opinion. On the issue of gun control, for instance, I've seen routine polls in my state of where people stand on certain types of gun control thing. Assault rifle ban, on waiting period for purchasing guns, for registration of guns, and so on. They tend to be, depending on the issue, between 60% and 80% support for such measures. On assault rifles, probably 90% of the public supports bans on assault rifles. Yet, of the 10% or so who's on the other side of it, I'll say 20% don't know or don't care depending on the issue, but there's 5 to 10% who routinely will oppose any form of any kind of gun control, totally. And so if somebody goes and votes with the 70%, I will suggest that that's a courageous vote in terms of the political survivability of that individual, because not because they're going with a minority of their constituents, but because the only people who pay attention to that issue are the people in that special, in that single issue group. I'll guess 5 to 10% of the public votes, single issue voters, on gun control. And I'll guess that 95% of those single issue voters are anti-gun control, totally in any way, shape, or form. And regardless of the merits of the issue or where you stand on the issue, politically, I know a whole lot of my colleagues who will say, yeah, they support some sorts of things, but oh, no, no, they're not going to take on the National Rifle Association or some of the local anti-gun control groups because of the political clout of them. It doesn't matter where the public opinion is on that kind of an issue. There is the single issue group, and they're the only ones who vote on that issue. The third kind of pressure I would argue that there is special interest lobbies. I'll give two examples of that. One, a couple years ago, we had an issue in Minnesota on registration rates for dealer plates, auto dealer plates. In Minnesota, you pay for your plate depending on the value of the car. A new expensive car, you're going to be paying very high registration fees, and every year the car gets older, the fee goes down, and the cheaper the car to start with, the lower it starts. So it's, whether that's a good system or not, it's a it's a system in which the value of the car is taken into account when you pay your annual registration fee for the driver's, for the license plates. And, well, is that appropriate? That's not bad as far as I'm concerned. They have special needs for these special plates, but the law was written in such a way that anybody in Minnesota, if you work for an auto dealer, if you're a showroom salesperson or a spouse of a showroom salesperson or even a kid of a showroom salesperson, as long as that person drives the dealer cars, and they tend to drive new cars to advertise the dealer's cars, you are paying $15 a year for your registration fee. Well, what's the crime in that? A little benefit for them. Well, assuming you have a fixed amount of dollars you're going to spend on road maintenance and things like that, if they're paying less than their fair share, somebody else or everybody else is paying more. Who cares about the issue? Well, I'd argue every citizen would care, but it's a pretty small issue. If we give these dealer plates, it may be a couple $1 million a year, so it may be a couple of pennies for maybe a quarter a year for every other constituent, and it's not a big deal to them. Who's going to write their legislator about an issue that raises their vehicle fees by a quarter a year in the long term? Nobody. So the only people who are interested in it are the auto industry. And sure enough, a vote came up on upping these things or restricting them only to business purposes. And after a couple of votes on them, one colleague who sits near me from each party both made comments about how, oh yeah, they've been pretty good to us. Or the other one said something like, yeah, they're always pretty helpful to me. What do they mean by that? Well, I'll suggest the lobbyist for the auto dealers who was sitting in the gallery watching the vote does contribute to campaigns. I can tell you exactly where all the auto dealerships in my district are, and there are a good number of them, and they have a good number of employees, and all those employees are aware of how you vote on those things. And the other 99.5% of your constituents don't have the foggiest idea of the issue, or they don't care about it. And so the easy thing to do is to vote with this single issue group. Fairness of it, well, the fairness is that you represent the general public interest. You don't try and stick it to this industry unfairly, but you figure, let's make a fair system to everybody. But the only political credit you get from it are for voting in favor of that one special interest thing. A similar type of thing will happen. I've spent a lot of time working on utility issues, and a couple of years ago, there was a federal law changes that in effect cut taxes for utilities, and since a number of them in Minnesota were under our regulatory system probably over-earning in the rate of return they're allowed to get, I was passing on a thing that said that they have to return, that they have to come in for a rate case to get a new rate of return allowed, otherwise they have to reduce their rates by amount of this tax reduction. And who cared about that one? Well, the industry lobbyists for them consisted of 20 or 30 people full-time around the Capitol. It was a big issue to them. Everybody else who I'd argue is of interest in getting reasonable rates, I don't want to, again, utility companies have a right to make a decent rate of return as any other business does. But in terms of trying to argue the fairness of the issue, that was totally lost. The only side out there was the particular special interest lobby in that case. And they have every right, I'm not criticizing them for being there and for fighting for what they're fighting for. We all, in everything we do, we try and put the best light on, we're trying to help our own business, our own job, our own whatever. And so it's human nature to do that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with it any more than there's anything wrong with advertising or marketing your products in the smartest way you can. You don't go tell people who you know. If you're selling baby clothes, you don't go advertise to senior citizens. You advertise to young families. So you market things to the appropriate audience, and you try your best to sell your product the right way. So these businesses are doing their best to sell their product or their cause or their concern to their government, which is appropriate. But you need leadership in order to stand up to that. And finally, among colleagues, there's clubby atmosphere always in a legislative branch, certainly. You want to be popular, you want to be friends, that's human nature, and the people you spend a lot of time with at the Capitol, you want to get along with them. So you propose something that that you think would be helpful to improving the process that they don't like. You quickly can become an outcast or a chump or something like that. And why are you doing this? There's certainly that same kind of interest there too. All of these things, I would argue, push people away from making the tough decisions. And I better wrap up quickly so we can get some discussion. But I'd suggest some of the issues of leadership that get pushed aside because of these pressures. And I'd say they're all strong pressures, not just public opinion, but the special interest groups and the single issue groups and the political in-house stuff. All of those things have real strong clout on people. And as a result of this, I'd suggest the long term, I think that relates to the vision issue before, you were mentioning the prevention of problems or looking ahead to find answers. We look very much at the short term. Some of that is this pressure, some of it's human nature that we look at what happens tomorrow. But we're looking for short-term payback, things that pay back before the next election. So we do a lot more crisis management than we do prevention. Along with this, we look more often at the self-interest of our own local neighborhood, our own community, our own vocal constituents, rather than the broader public good often. And I'd suggest leadership means looking at the long term. Leadership means looking at the preventive approach. Leadership means looking at the community interest. And leadership does not mean appealing to greed or selfishness. I think most political candidates in making their appeals on taxes are appealing to people's greed. I've heard people go out, who do you think could better spend another $100, you or your government? And I take a poll of the room, I think virtually everybody thinks they could spend it better. And you do appeal, I think you can appeal to the fact, as some people have in the past, that, boy, we want to take care of seniors in nursing homes, we want to have decent housing for the poor, we want to do certain things in a certain way, and we care about that, and you can make a broad, generous appeal to people, and they'll respond with generosity. If you appeal to selfishness, I think they respond with selfishness. But I think leadership means appealing to selflessness. It means not appealing to fear, to bigotry, to hatred. It does not mean appealing to ignorance. It means making positive appeals to people, and I'd argue that those positive appeals can succeed. They don't always succeed, and that's where the risk lies in political leadership. People are going to lose elections by being leaders. A whole lot of great leaders have never succeeded. While John F. Kennedy may not be everybody's model of a president, at least he talked in some ways, his inaugural address talking about ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. That's very much a generous appeal. You're appealing to people's generosity, their concern for others. Peace Corps, VISTA types of things were programs that were put in place in which people are asked to serve other people. And there are some who will say that, well, yeah, this is all well and good, but nobody does it because it doesn't work. I'd argue that if you suggest that leadership cannot work, you have a very, very pessimistic view of human nature, and that you don't think that people can go beyond ignorance or prejudice or whatever. And I'd suggest what the leadership means is moving us away from what we have now, a followership, on whatever the issue. You wait and you see people offended by flag burning, so then you go out there and you say, I'm going to lead the charge to get rid of all these flag burners, which I didn't know there were a whole lot of it going on until it became a big issue. Then every now and then you'll hear of somebody doing it. But I'd say that's followership, to find out where public opinion is and then go lead the front of the parade for it. I'd say leadership is the opposite. It means when you have a vision for what should be, you recognize the fact not everybody's going to go along with that, but you're willing to take a risk because you really believe in it. And with that, I guess I'd like to open it up for discussion or debate on any of these points or questions.
Senator, I'm amazed you didn't bring in the pressure of the editorial policy of broadcast and printed journalism in this process. My personal observation is that a large number of your constituents play to the camera, as that is the 99.9% direction of public opinion is...
It's coming from the media, Eric.
...what is broadcast. So, you know, it seems to me that it's tremendously powerful medium in shaping public opinion, and therefore is in and of itself an absolutely incredible barrier to overcome.
I guess I agree with you fully that the media is a powerful thing. I guess I think of that in terms of the public opinion. They certainly shape public opinion, and we could get into that for a long part of the discussion, because they do play a major role, and perhaps I should distinguish that from just general public opinion. But they are, when we're talking public opinion, you're right. I mean, they are shaping public opinion, and certainly you can't always guess how the media is going to respond to something. I can tell you which issues they're going to tend to be really interested in. And you can certainly, if you want to play to the media, you can certainly do that. And people are learning very quickly how to do that. It's changed a lot in the last few years. I think I mentioned yesterday this average length of soundbite from the 84 to 88 presidential campaigns on the network news had dropped from like 40-some seconds down to 9 seconds in just 4 years. And that means that 1984, Reagan and Mondale both, every time they'd quote him, they'd give him 40-some seconds of quote, which is a fairly lengthy quote. You get a lot said in 40-some seconds, maybe not an hour's talk worth, but you can at least get something more than a clever line. 9 seconds is nothing more than the most clever quote you can say, and that's what the average length was in 1988. And so the media certainly has a powerful impact, and people are trying to think of things, and they certainly look in making their judgments on how it's going to play in public opinion through the media, because the media is clearly the way that what happens gets channeled there. You're right, it's a good point. I should bring that up. I should. But it is public opinion.
When they just had the congressional pay raise, we were laughing at work, and I said, well, the ones that are close to election will be against it. The ones who have got a long ways to go are going to be for it.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. And it's exactly what happened.
That's very true, and they count on people. In the U.S. Senate, they count on people changing or forgetting certain things over a six-year period of time, which is a long time in the political world. And that's what happened of the 30-some, 33 or 34, they're up next year. Something like 8 or 9 supported it, and obviously with the majority supporting it, had to be like 2/3 of the other ones supporting it. So, but how things play in the media, how... is in my mind part of the public opinion thing that they recognize the media on the pay raise issue. The media is going to play it up real big for 2 days, 3 days, and then it's gone. And it's kind of a stale issue 5 years later. Yes?
It seems to me one of the real problems in our system is the inordinate role that money plays in getting elected, getting reelected. We hear about public funding of campaigns. What is the way out of this, in your view? It seems to me that it's the main stifling effect that we have on our democratic experiment.
I'm not going to disagree with that. And of these groups, it's clearly the special interest lobby that does put that money out there. And it's awesome. It is very destructive of the process. Several years ago, one congressman explained how serious the problem is by asking people or suggesting, does anybody else? I have gotten contributions of as much as $500 from people I've never met and never didn't know anything about and so on. How many of you have ever gotten $500 in contributions from somebody you ever met and never met? None of you. Well, you did.
Go to seminary churches.
Okay. Church is a special interest group that you've got to appease now. It's a new way of looking at it. And certainly a lot of us have gotten student loans and other things. But in the political process, I think the idea that total stranger or lobbying group comes up to you and says, "Oh, you think you're a wonderful person," and gives you large sums of money in the federal level, literally thousands of dollars, you're foolish to expect that they're doing it without any expectation of return on that. And the number of candidates who, the number of interest groups who give money to both sides of the issue shows what a problem it is. When I was first elected, I wasn't supposed to win, and I got a nice letter from a person I thought was a good friend several years earlier who happened to do some lobbying, sent me a real nice handwritten note. One of my clients, the so-and-so, was a medical profession, had the, quote, misfortune of giving $400 to your opponent. Here's $400 as they wish to make amends. Well, it's very, very cynical. They didn't give 400 bucks because they thought that my opponent was going to be better for the state of Minnesota or even better for their own industry. They did it because they thought he was going to win. They knew he was going to win. And all of a sudden I surprised them and beat this guy, so well, they better, quote, make amends to me. And it shows how cynical the money impact has become, and you do need money, and you do need it. I'd say a number of states, including Minnesota, have done a tremendous amount to reduce special interest dollars. The federal government has done zero. And I'd suggest the things we have to do. In Minnesota, we've tried. I mean, we passed a bill last year that hasn't been tested yet because it didn't apply until this year after last year's elections. But it limits the amount of money a U.S. senator, congressional candidate can spend. It puts a cap on it. Because of a Supreme Court ruling, it's a voluntary cap, but we put heavy enough of incentives in there that you don't have much choice. It's kind of mandatory more than voluntary. Because it gives, if your opponent skips the spending limit, which we set it, I think, a reasonable amount, if it's too low, it is incumbent protection because incumbents are the only ones able to get the word out, and if it's too high, it's incumbent protection because they're the only ones able to raise the money. So we tried to set a fair limit, and then if your opponent skips the limit, then you are given a cash grant. In our U.S. Senate races, it was going to be, my proposal was $2 million. I think it ended up being $1 million. A cash grant from the states is a campaign contribution, and certain tax credits that you're allowed, so you get more contributions from the public, and you're allowed to skip the limit as well. So it was supposed to mean a real heavy hammer to force both candidates to accept the limit. If both candidates accepted the limits, they both get the tax credit for contributions, but that was it. And I think if that holds up in the courts, I think a lot of other states will try the same thing, because I don't think the U.S. Congress is likely to act soon. Because of self-interest. They all got elected under this system. It's very favorable to incumbents. They're not likely to change it. But I argue it is the most important thing we have to do in terms of government reform, is cutting back the money. And that would mean spending limits, contribution limits, some public finance money, and limits in terms of contribution limits. I don't think of PACs is more evil than individual contributions. With the auto dealer example I gave before, well, if we ban the PAC, that will give you $1,000 from the auto dealer PAC. Well, I'll just as easily get $2,000 from $100 contributions from individual auto dealers. Instead of them giving through the PAC, they give you directly. It's the same special interest, and they can bundle all those checks together and hand them to you, has the same impact. So I would argue that you have to limit all the special interest dollars. You have to make much more in public money and in smaller contributions, and you have to have limits, and firm limits that people can't avoid just because they have access to more money.
Our governor of Florida, Childs, won claiming that no one had given him more than $100 each. Mm-hmm. Is it practical to make such a law that no one could receive more than $100 each?
Yes, I think it is. I guess I have real concern that it be done the right way, because you certainly can favor certain candidates by doing that. Giles is a very unusual person who can make a big issue of that and succeed on it. I've decided as of January 1st of this year, I wasn't accepting any more contributions from lobbyists or PACs, And I could make that because, first of all, I think I'm going to be able to raise the money to meet our spending limits for next year. And I can do it without that because of public finance money and because of a reasonable limit. I think I can succeed in that. I didn't send out a press release saying I'm not accepting PACs or anything. I've sent back a number of contributions I've received since then, unsolicited contributions that just come in from time to time because I'm an incumbent and they want to let me know what a great job I'm doing, even if I haven't been real supportive of their concerns. They want me to know how wonderful they think I am. And I can do that. And why am I doing it? It makes more work in raising the money I need to get it. I want to, first of all, show that it can be done, and second of all, encourage us to, I think, a few more reforms, and it will make it fair to everyone. I wouldn't want to mandate right now in Minnesota that no candidate could accept lobbyist or PAC contributions under current laws, because especially in greater Minnesota, it's tougher to raise money, and new candidates aren't going to have a chance. I didn't have a chance in 1986 when I first won against a candidate who everybody knew was going to win, other than the fact that we had between Minnesota and the federal government, there was a tax credit for contributions. A couple of individual could give me $100 and they'd get a $50 tax credit in Minnesota, $50 tax credit from the federal government at the time. And so, in effect, they'd get 100% refund on their contribution. I contacted every old college faculty member, every friend, everybody else, people who would give me money not because I represented some special interest, but people who trusted me, thought I could do a good job, thought I deserved a chance. I raised the money I needed to reach the spending limit, and I did succeed in winning the election. I want to see it that we can do that everywhere in the country. I think we should ban large contributions. I think we should ban lobbyist contributions. I think we should ban PAC contributions. I think we should do a lot away with the gifts to legislators. I think we have to do those things. I think we got to do the campaign-related ones cautiously so we don't make it even more incumbent protection.
Who should I make my check out to for $100? I mean, if you get this through, I think it'd be a real blessing because I think we've got the finest government in the world and have had, the finest government in the world. And yet there are some problems, and the better we can make it, mm-hmm. the better we can encourage other nations to follow our example. So I'm not critical of what has gone on. I think it's mm-hmm. fantastic that God has permitted our nation to get where it has under the system we have. But you can always improve.
Yeah. And when people talk about, I think public financing is a big part of elections. It's a controversial issue because when I say I support public financing of elections, you mean you're going to take our taxes and use them to fund your own campaigns? That's the gut level reaction. The thing you have to point out is Charles Keating in the SNL crisis. He was the Keating Five in the U.S. Senate who are still, I mean, it's real touchy what you do with them, and I don't want to condemn them not knowing the specifics of it, but clearly there were some things going on there that were inappropriate. And they asked Keating afterwards if he thought his contributions made any difference. He said, I sure hope they did. He had the expectation they were going to make a difference. Certainly looks like it may have made a difference. Even if it just looked like it, even if there wasn't a real problem there, and I'd argue there is one, why should we be having people who have a specific interest in the government giving $5,000 to certain legislators? It certainly is a conflict of interest there, and the delay caused by interference with the regulatory process and closing down his Lincoln SNL cost taxpayers $1 billion. I mean, $1 billion, frankly, would fund an entire campaign finance system for the entire federal government. And I'd say it's worth the money. I'd say it's a good deal for taxpayers to have the taxpayers funding elections instead of special interest groups. I'd say in the long run it would be a bargain. I say that with caution because you don't want to be, first of all, you don't want to be wasting the money, and second of all, if you don't do it right, you're going to keep protecting incumbents still. We're done in, I still see 3 minutes in. So one more question.
One of God's commandments was thou shalt not kill. What do you think God's feeling would be towards capital punishment?
Good to hear
the rest of the day, huh? Thank you.
On that note, I will close it up, and I'm happy to talk more about capital punishment or any issue further, but I thank you all for coming.